The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
The theme of this retreat is the best of both worlds. It's not only the best of both worlds because it's a very nice place, so it's physically attractive, and hopefully the teachings that we'll share with you are deep and spiritually inspiring, so it's the best of both worlds, but that's really the theme of what we would like to share with you in understanding what Jewish life is really offering us, which is the best of both worlds. Now, most Jews, I would say, perhaps even Orthodox Jews, are totally unaware of this. They think that somehow, if a person becomes involved in Judaism, then they're giving up a world, right? And most of the time they figure out they're probably giving up the physical, the aesthetic, right? But some people think they're actually giving up the spiritual, right? So tonight I want to share with you the goal. And the goal of Jewish life is to be whole, okay? But most people don't know that. So a number of years ago, one of the students of Israelite, who was also a friend, which I consider all the students of Israelite my friends, he was in Yerushalayim, he was in Jerusalem, and some of his friends of his family were visiting, right, at the King David Hotel. So he said, "Rabbi, would you like to join me? There's this cocktail party. I'm going to see some friends and old family." So I said, "Sure." I said, "But only under one condition, that you don't tell them I'm a rabbi, because I would like to have a good time, right?" And if they know I'm a rabbi, then you know what happens when people find out you're a rabbi? All these walls go up. They have all these stereotypes of what a rabbi is. And they assume that rabbis, you have to talk about Judaism or spirituality or something like that. No, I didn't want that. I just wanted to have a good time. So we're going to a cocktail party, we're going to drink, and we're going to have fun. Okay, but I don't want to be a rabbi. I said, "Okay, fine." Okay, so he just introduced me as David. Fine. So we get to the hotel. And none of the people were a little surprised to see him, because the last time they saw him, he wasn't wearing a kippah. He wasn't wearing a, well, I don't know, some people call it a kippah, some people call it a yarmulke, some people call it a skull cap, whatever this thing is, okay? And so they were a little surprised. And they were a little condescending towards him. Like, I remember one woman saying, "Oh, Stephen, I'm so happy you finally found yourself." You know, it was like, really, you know, like, "You're such a loser, Stephen. At least you're now in yeshiva and you're off the streets, you're not doing drugs." So that was the attitude. Right, that was the attitude. Anyway, so we're getting in conversation, and I'm schmoozing, I'm talking to some people, we're talking about music, we're talking about theater, we're talking about politics, and somehow Steve makes a mistake, and he says, "Well, you know, in one of the classes of Rabbi Aaron," and all of a sudden there was this, like, awkward silence in the room. "Rabbi Aaron, right? You're a rabbi?" And immediately I saw these walls go, you know, right? And there was this awkward silence, like, "Oh no, what do we do with a rabbi? Like, what do you say to a rabbi?" Right? I mean, now we've been talking, and they felt like bad, like, "Oh, we're sorry, we were speaking music with you." What, you know, and there was this, like, uncomfortable experience all of a sudden, like, "He's a rabbi." So suddenly this one person comes towards me and say, "Rabbi, I have a question." Right? So it's too late, So what did I do? I went, "Yes." That's why I have this, right? Right? I take it off at night, right? That's why I have this. Actually, someone suggested I paint it white for the occasion tonight, you know, with my little red hat, but we didn't do that. So I said, "Yes." So she said, "Rabbi, you know, the other day I was in Mea Shearim, in that, you know, ultra-religious community," which I always think is very interesting, ultra-religious, you know, like this toothpaste, ultra-bright, right? Ultra-bright gives you sex appeal, right? So ultra-religious, I don't know what it does to you, right? Right? So we were in Mea Shearim, and we were in this falafel store. We saw this religious Jew, you know, like, you know, the guys with the curly doggy ear things, what do you call it? I said, "Peyote." They said, "Right, right, peyote, right." So we saw this one fellow, and he was about to eat his falafel, right? Well, so, "Rabbi, why is it that before religious Jews eat their falafel, they scrape their shoe against the floor?" I said, "Excuse me?" See, I'm not ultra-Orthodox. I don't know these things. So I said, "I don't understand." She said, "Rabbi, I saw this, again, one of those guys with the peyote, right, right. And before he ate his falafel, he went like this on the floor. So I said, he probably had something on his shoe. She said, oh, come on, Rabbi, you can tell me. I'm telling you, Rabbi, there's no question. This was a religious ritualistic thing he was doing. It was clear. It was very clear. I said, I'm telling you, I don't know what you're talking about. And he must have had something on his shoe. And she wouldn't accept that. But what I found so interesting is that there's this sense that someone who's involved in Jewish life seriously is seriously crazy. Right? That they do all these strange little ritualistic things that are off the wall, right? And therefore, that's what I guess it's all about. So unfortunately for some people, to understand Jewish life is really offering us the best of both worlds. And that the goal of Jewish life is to be whole. When most people unfortunately think that the goal of Jewish life is to fragment you, to take the two worlds of the physical and the spiritual, of the temporal and the eternal, and separate it apart. Right? And this is classic about religion in general. Right? The word religion has a stigma. You know, when people say, I'm learning religion, people look at you with this like, ugh. I thought you were normal. You okay? Why do you want to do that? And I know, you know, I've asked students that do Israelite seminars, and I say, well, you know, when you came to Israel and you shared with your friends what you were going to do and you told your friend you're going to learn about Judaism, what were their responses? It's really amazing. People are really scared. They look at like, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on? And one student told me that all her friends would say, I hope you won't lose your sense of humor. Because you're just so funny, that would be so sad. Right? And that was the assumption. But you see, this is like classic. For instance, Karl Marx. Everybody knows what Karl Marx said about religion. What did he say? I guess not everybody knows. We know that better than Ten Commandments. We know that Karl Marx said that religion is the opiate of the masses. I don't know what's so bad about that. What's wrong with opium? Well, opiate is the opiate of the masses, which means that the masses who are not intelligent, who are not deep, who are not sophisticated, who are looking for some crutch, who are looking for some kind of escape, that's why they turn to religion. Okay? Maybe you're familiar with what Nietzsche said, the great German philosopher, right? What did he say about religion? Nietzsche said that there's two types of people in the world. There are strong people, and there are weak people. The strong people do what they want, when they want, and where they want. They basically have fun, right? That's the strong people. The weak people, they're weak, right? But they're smart. What did the weak people do? The weak people invented morality. Why? To protect themselves from the strong people. Because what did the weak people do? By fabricating morality, they were able to get all the strong people to feel guilty that they're so strong. Okay? And who are the people, the weak people, who invented morality? It's the Jews. The Jews invented morality. The Jews invented guilt. Which I think might be true, actually. Right? The Jews invented guilt. And that's why there's so much problem in the world. Everybody was having a good time. It was party, party, party. And the Jews are the big party poopers, right? And they invented morality to make all the strong people feel guilty. So very often people think that religion, and unfortunately they put Judaism in that category, which I don't believe it should be there, right? And they think that religion has come to undermine the fun, the adventure, the empowerment of life. And I know that's not true in my own life, and I know that's not true about Judaism, but unfortunately, so many people think that Judaism teaches us a way that fragments our lives and undermines the possibility of really having a great time. Okay? So, what really is Judaism about? It's about being whole. But a lot of Jews don't know that. And I often ask people to just close their eyes and imagine a holy person. Right? Imagine a holy person. Whatever comes to your mind. Now, very often, the image that people get is an old man with a white beard, with a pale face, kind of hunched over like this, maybe with a cane. And that for them would be the image of a holy person, a tzaddik. And that's very sad. But I have to admit that I had that very same image when I was growing up. Also, I thought to be holy means to be sick, to be old, to be frail, to be pale, right? And the truth is that the place I got that picture was from a painting that my parents brought from Jerusalem, right, on one of their trips, right? Now, maybe you've seen this painting, because it's kind of a classic painting. It's a painting of rabbis, three rabbis in this gloomy, dark room. And they've got these books piled up on the table. One rabbi's going like this, oof, right? The other one's going like this, oof. Right? The other one's going like this, no! Right? And that was the picture that I had of Judaism. And I did not want to be in that picture. If that's really the goal of Judaism, that the real success stories, the pros, they're old and they're frail and they spend all their life sitting in rooms that are gloomy, arguing over minutia, I don't want that. I don't want that. But the truth is, so many Jewish people actually believe that that's the goal of Jewish life, right? That would be a holy person. Do you know who is referred to in Judaism as the tzaddik, the holy person? A man named Joseph, Yosef, right? Now, if you've seen some of the stories in the Bible about Joseph, you really don't see him as an old man. There's not much discussion about him as an old man. You see this very young, dynamic, charismatic fellow who's a dream interpreter, right? They say that he was so handsome that in Egypt he became a fertility symbol, and that the women would literally climb walls to just take a look at this fellow, right? He becomes functionally the right-hand man, or functionally becomes the king of Egypt. The king gives him his ring, and he is wearing the finest clothing of Egypt. He speaks a perfect Egyptian, right? He is young, he is dynamic, he is charismatic. By the way, he's single. No, I'm just, right? He's young, he's dynamic, he's charismatic. He's in this world, and yet he's totally committed to his Judaism, right? That was the image of the tzaddik in the Torah. But most people don't understand that, right? Most people's image of a rabbi is, again, the old, or they only wear black and white. Not that there aren't rabbis who don't wear black, who do wear black and white, but is that the only image necessarily of Jewish life? So, you know, and I have to admit that this is kind of the way I thought about Judaism. My whole relationship to Judaism was based on guilt also, you know? I grew up very aware of the Holocaust. I grew up very aware of all the pain that the Jewish people have gone through and all the suffering that people have gone through. I experienced anti-Semitism myself because I grew up in a completely Catholic neighborhood until I was 13 years old. And my attitude towards Judaism was not positive. It wasn't a source of joy. It didn't seem like a source of empowerment. And even later on, when I finally decided to get more involved in Judaism, started learning in yeshiva, and I was going towards my rabbinical ordination, I still had some problems in truly understanding what Judaism is all about. Well, after a number of years in yeshiva, I decided that I wanted to go out and teach. I wanted to start Israelite. I wanted to get out there and do. But I wasn't quite sure because I was young. It was like I was in my early 20s. I was 22, 23 years old. And I really wanted to get out there and teach and like change the world, you know. But I decided maybe I'll go ask a rabbi and get his opinion. So I went to one of the greatest sages of our generation, a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Eliashiv. Right? And I wanted to know, what's my responsibility? I'm young, I've been learning in yeshiva for a number of years, but certainly not 20, 30 years. And what is my responsibility? I know that what's going on with the Jewish people is very sad, the assimilation rate is so huge, and we're losing so many of our people. Right? I really wanted to get out there. So I went to Rabbi Eliashiv and I asked him, Rabbi, what is my responsibility? What does God want from me? Right? So he said, you have no responsibility right now to the community. God wants you to sit and learn and become a Torah scholar. Right? So I don't know why, but I must have made a like sour, contorted face, because that wasn't the answer I wanted. Right? And thank God, Rabbi Eliashiv was very sensitive, and he said, well, what's wrong? I said, what do you mean what's wrong? Because he noticed that I kind of went, ugh, right? Because I wasn't happy with the answer. Right? So he said, well, what's wrong? So I just blurted out, I said, you know, Rabbi, I'm not happy learning in yeshiva anymore, right? I'm really itching to get out there and teach. So the rabbi said to me, well, then why didn't you tell me that? Why are you asking questions? So I thought, that's so strange that you always go to rabbis to ask questions. So I said, excuse me? I mean, like, you're one of the biggest rabbis in our generation. Everybody goes to you to ask a question. He says, why are you asking questions? I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, obviously God wants you to be happy. Now, that was a shock to me. I didn't even know that, right? So, yeah? He says, yeah, of course. You didn't tell me you weren't happy in yeshiva. I thought you were happy studying in yeshiva. And you were wondering whether you had a responsibility to go out and teach. And at your age, you don't have a responsibility to go out and teach. But if you're not happy there, well, then teaching is a great thing. And you should be happy. Now, imagine if that rabbi didn't have the sensitivity to see that little contorted sour face I made and ask me what's going on. I probably would have walked out of his office, sat in yeshiva for another 10 years, and feel happy that I'm so miserable in yeshiva, right? Right? Feeling that I have fulfilled my obligations as a Jew, which is to be a holy martyr. Because that's what I thought Judaism was all about. It's about being a holy martyr. What's it got to do with being happy? What's it got to do about being whole? And that's the sad thing. I didn't understand that, and a great rabbi, one of the greatest, had to teach me such a simple lesson in Judaism. The Jewish life is about being happy. Jewish life really is about being whole. Now let's try and understand that even more. You know, this confusion we find in the Bible itself between two interesting characters, which were just a couple of portions ago in, when we read the weekly portion. You have a fellow by the name of Yaakov, Jacob, and you have his brother named Esav. And they're having this very interesting kind of dialogue. And maybe you know the story. Jacob is cooking up this stew, this kind of bean stew. Why? Because Abraham died. Okay? And it was traditional in those days that a person who was in mourning, which was Isaac, Jacob and Esau's father, was in mourning. So Jacob was preparing this particular meal, which mourners eat. Okay? This kind of lentil soup or stew. Esau walks in. Esau's a real Marlboro man. Yeah? Tough. Right? Macho kind of guy. A real field, you know, hunter. He comes in. He says, hey, bro. What's going on? What you cooking over there? Right? He says, what's that red stuff? Right? So the brother says, well, you know, Zadie died. Abraham died. Right? So Esau says, well, then there's no revival of the dead. There's no world to come. There's no afterlife. And he starts denying all the principles of Judaism, according to our Midrashic literature. A very strange story. Right? Strange kind of response. I mean, it's not like Abraham died this tragic, sudden death. He died at a very old age. Right? So why would that challenge your faith? Right? But when he hears that his grandfather dies, he begins to denounce all the principles of faith that he'd learned from his grandfather and from his father. Right? And he says, hey, bro, pour that red stuff down my throat. So it's a strange story. Yaakov says to Esau, he says, well, I'll do it for your birthright. Right? Which is a free trip to Israel. I'm just joking. Right? I'll do it to your birthright. I'll do it to your birthright. How do you sell a birthright? A strange story. Why do you want to buy a birthright? Right? And in fact, Esau says, sounds like a good deal. You take my birthright and I get the beans. All right. But the Midrash says that there's a little more to the dialogue. The Midrash says that Esau says to his brother, hey brother, why do you want the birthright? Like, what do you get out of it? We live in Israel. Now, what do you get out of it? So the oral tradition says, well, the firstborn is going to have the possibility or the responsibility to serve in the temple, to do the sacrificial service in the temple. Right? So Esau says, yeah, what's that mean? What's it going to entail? He said, well, you know, if you are serving in the temple and you come with your hair all undone, disheveled, right? Well, then that's punishable by death. Now, if you know anything about Esau, he was this hairy monkey-looking kind of guy. He said, whoa, I don't want that. Okay? He said, well, what else is it? Well, if you go in there and you had a couple of drinks, that's punishable by death. And that's what I do. I party all day long. Right? So that's why the Midrash, the oral tradition, says that Esau said, well, if that's the case, then I'm going to die. Right? I don't want this birthright. So he says, okay, I'll sell it to you. Now, what's this story really all about? What are they really talking about? Right? They're talking about the good life or the God life. Because for Ace of the good life is to party, 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 do what I feel. It's the Nietzsche strong one. Do what I want, where I want, when I want, not accountable to anybody, and just Fun, right? Basically, the idea is eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we may die. So get it all now, and get it fast. Seize the moment. That was Esau's attitude. Yaakov's attitude is, no. A life without spirituality is a life without meaning, without depth. And therefore, why would he want this opportunity to serve in the temple? Jewish tradition tells us that in actuality, it's almost impossible to ever get death penalty in Judaism. If you open up the Bible, you'll see it talks about death penalty, right? But in actuality, it's almost impossible to ever get in a judicious situation in the courts of Judaism to ever get to such a place, right? For instance, if a person breaks Shabbat, right, then it's punishable by death according to the Bible, right? Punishable by a punishment called stoning. In fact, I have a friend who went to a religious camp, and on Shabbat, he would light a match. And he said, I am now obligated to get stoned. That's what he did, because he was religious, right? And he shared it with his friends, right? And they light the... got to use the light for something, so they lit up a reefer, and they got stoned, right? But what is it that Yaakov understood? Yaakov understood that when the stakes are high, then that means there's so much life in this tradition. If something could be technically, theoretically punishable by death, even though essentially it won't happen almost ever, but the powerful message of the Torah of the Bible is to understand that if one celebrates and if one engages themselves in Jewish life, they will find so much power and so much life and so much inspiration in it. Now, I didn't understand that growing up in Judaism, right? I hated Hebrew school, like a lot of people seem to have had a poor experience with Hebrew school. And I really only understood and discovered Judaism much later in my life, right? But the true goal of Jewish life is to be whole. And Esau thought, if I'm going to embrace Jewish life, that means giving up this world, right? And Yaakov, and it's about, I guess, you religious people who live for the next world and give up the beauties and the joys and the fun of this world. And that's not true. Jewish tradition is interested in the best of both worlds. It's living a meaningful spiritual life in this world and deeply, profoundly enjoying this world. So, you know, the path of Judaism is the path to holiness. And again, it's one of those words that most people don't understand. What holiness? Who wants to be holy? But the true meaning of holiness is wholeness. To be whole, right? That's what holiness is. And very often people confuse Judaism thinking that it is a path to spirituality. But it's not a path to spirituality. Judaism isn't interested in spirituality. It's interested in holiness. Because spirituality is the opposite of physicality. They're in conflict when people do that. I'm spiritual, I'm not materialistic. But Jewish tradition is interested in holiness. Holiness is uniting the best of these two worlds, the physical and the spiritual, the body and the soul, the temporal and the eternal, are united in the life experience. That's what holiness is about. And this attitude about spirituality and physicality, I think personally, is very much coming from the Christian world, you know? That there's a sense that, for instance, sexuality, right, in some schools of thought of Christianity is terrible. The holy person in Christianity doesn't get married, doesn't have any sexual contact whatsoever. That's the holy person. In Jewish tradition, the holy person gets married, has children, right? But that's something that people don't seem to understand. They think that there's something called the Judaic-Christian tradition. Judaism and Christianity have almost nothing to do with each other. Almost nothing to do with each other. When you understand the true principles of Christianity and Judaism, it's confusing. Because in some schools of thought in Christianity, and I'm not going, this is not about comparative religion, but just to understand Judaism better, there is this attitude towards sex and the body being relating to the evil, belonging to the evil, and the holy person, the sacred person, removes themselves, divorces themselves, and goes to some retreat in Orlando, just joking, goes to a retreat, right, and removes and isolates themselves, right? Right? From the world. Right? You know, and there's like monasteries where people don't talk. You know? I understand that there's one monastery that person, only one person every year is allowed to say just a couple words. Right? So it was the first year this guy comes in and they say, okay, so and so will say first words. Right? They were having lunch. Right? And fellow said, "This soup is cold." That was it for a year. Okay? Nobody speaks for a year. Right? Then the next year, they say, you know, next person was honored with the opportunity to say a few words. So he gets up, he says, "Well, it's not so bad." Right? That's it for a year. Right? Then the next year, again, someone has an opportunity to say, and they pick another guy. He gets up and says, "I can't stand all the bickering in this place." Okay? That's not the Jewish approach, obviously. Because we talk. We even talk with our hands. Even when we're not talking, we're talking. Right? My daughter said that there was a group of people on a boat, and it sunk. Right? And only Jewish man actually survived, because he kept talking. Right? So he was treading water, right? Okay? The Jewish attitude is not to divorce the physical from the spiritual. In fact, we believe that the physical needs the spiritual, and more than that, the spiritual needs the physical. And if you understand Jewish tradition, it's constantly bringing you back to the physical world. Constantly bringing you back to the physical world. In fact, one of the most amazing things about Judaism is we eat so much. Right? It's such a Jewish thing to eat. You know, it's such a booby type of thing. Eat a little more. You look like a skinny little chicken. You know, I mean, eating is such a big thing in Judaism. So much of Jewish tradition is bringing us back into the physical world. Okay? It's certainly not about leaving the physical world. In fact, it was explained to me that that's one of the understandings of the Jewish star. The Jewish star is a sign of wholeness and integration. There you have the triangle, right? They have the triangle, which suggests, so to speak, taking the physical world and elevating it up, right? But then you have the triangle going this way, right? Right? Which is the spiritual being infused into the physical. And they meet each other, right? But when you think of the Christian symbol, which is a cross, right? Which is like crossing something out. You have a line that could suggest the connection between heaven and earth, but then something cuts across it, okay? And perhaps, who knows, if there's some deep psychological sense there, you know, whether that was intentional, I don't know, right? But the Jewish idea is to synthesize, harmonize, unite the physical and the spiritual, bring them into an integration, bring them into a wholeness of spirit. Judaism is not a path to spirituality. I'm not a spiritual person, and I'm not interested in being spiritual. I'm interested in being whole. I want to be physical, I want to be spiritual, I want to be whole. That's the Jewish approach. That's what we want. But let's understand a little bit more what holiness really means. Straight from the Bible, from the Torah. It says in the Torah, there's a verse that says, "You shall be holy, because I, the Lord your God, is holy." And what does that mean? So it was a Hasidic master by the name of Rabbi Elimelech Tzvi Elimelech Shapiro. And he says, what does this mean? If God wants us to be holy, then why did he give us such gross appetites, right? I mean, like, make it difficult, right? Put us in a world with so much allurement, so much seduction, and give us an appetite for this stuff, right? Why? You know, to be on some mountain, that's easy to be holy, right? But that's not real holiness. That's spirituality. I remember one student came to Israelite, and I said, "Well, what did you do before it?" "Well, I was in the East." "What were you doing?" "I was on a mountain for about 4 months, and what you were doing, I was sitting there naked, focusing on my breath for 4 months." Right? That's amazing, right? And I said, "Yeah, and what were you trying to accomplish?" "Transcendence." "Okay, right? All right, fine." But that's not Judaism. Not that you can't spend a little time and, you know, meditate on your breath, right? I'm not against that, right? But the point is, it's not about leaving this world. It's not about divorcing ourselves from the physical. It's about being in this world. Why did God create us as such physical beings with such incredible physical drives? Because the holiness actually emerges out of that. How so? If it says, "You shall be holy, because I, God, am holy," what does "because I, God, am holy" have to do with "you should be holy"? The "I, God, is holy" is giving the reason why and how we should be holy. Just as I, God, am in this world and beyond this world, which we'll talk about more tomorrow, you have to be like me. I want you to be in this world and yet beyond this world at the same time. Right? That you don't become trapped, you don't become a victim, you don't become a slave to the physical world, and yet you also don't feel that you have to run from it. You can be in it and beyond it at the same time. Right? You can enjoy the physical, but you don't become trapped in it. You don't start having disorders about it. You enjoy it. You know when to enjoy. You know when to stop. You know when to start. You know when to stop. You know when it's enough. Now it's indulgence. That's not good. That makes us sick. Right? But that you should enjoy good food. That you enjoy this world. That's what Judaism is about. But Judaism believes that one enjoys this world when we infuse and unite, create a fusion of the spiritual and the physical. So the path of holiness is not the path of removing ourselves from this world. No, it's not at all that. It means that I'm completely in this world and I'm above this world at the same time. That's the real meaning of holiness. Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook explains the relationship between the secular and the holy is the same relation between matter and form. For instance, this table, its matter is wood, right? But its form is table, okay? So too, Rav Cook tells us, according to Jewish mysticism, that the relationship between the secular and the holy is the same relation between matter and form. The secular is the matter, the substance, the material, and our job is to bring a holy form to this material. Do you follow this? If you don't have the material, you don't have the form. If you don't have the form, then the material doesn't have the kind of value that it can have. But if you take a ring and make it out of plastic, it's a plastic ring. If you take a ring and make it out of gold, it's a golden ring. So Rav Cook explains that the more powerful and the richer your physical, material life is, the greater the potential of your holy life. Do you understand that? Because that's a very new idea for a lot of Jews, even Orthodox Jews sometimes. That if we are looking idealistically to diminish the secular, to undermine the material, we are actually undermining Judaism. Do you follow this? Yeah? That's why it says in the Talmud that if a person has a beautiful spouse, a beautiful house, and beautiful furnishings, that widens their mind. The physical world can enhance your spiritual experience. But, on the other hand, it widens your mind, but if you don't fill it with meaning, then it's empty. Right? So yes, it's widening the physical world, but then you have to fill it with spirit and unite spirit with the material. But that's the goal. But now I want to give you one last idea. Right? Rav Cook tells us that the relationship between the holy and the secular is actually the relationship between the physical and the spiritual. And the spiritual brings form to the physical. And the physical brings matter and substance to the spiritual. And the greater the matter, the greater the potential for the spiritual. You need both. But Rav Cook tells us something even more based on Kabbalah, which you find in other Hasidic writings, especially in the Hasidic writings of Chabad. Right? Rav Cook tells us that in fact, hidden in the physical is an even greater manifestation of holiness than in the spiritual. Could you imagine that? How do we know this in Jewish tradition in a simple way? But listen very carefully. Rav Cook explains that when the holy, so to speak, becomes manifest in this world, because we're not ready, the highest holiness needs to be hidden. The lower holiness can be revealed. So from our perspective, that which seems holy is actually the lower holiness. And that which seems unholy and purely material and secular is actually the deepest holiness, but hidden. And our job in this world is to reveal the holiness in everything, everyone. Even in the places that seem so secular and so divorced from any spiritual value, even there is hidden the highest of the highest holiness. Now listen to this last idea. Some of you might be familiar with the idea of the revival of the dead. Have you heard of that idea? Jewish tradition teaches us that there will come a period in history called the revival of the dead. Right? We are taught that there's a 6,000-year history. By the end of the 6,000 years, an individual by the name of Mashiach will come, Messiah, Mashiach, will come and bring peace to the world. After that period of time, 40 years later, after the Messiah will come, we will have this phenomena of what's called the revival of the dead. And everyone who died will come back to life again. It's an amazing idea. You know, I kind of get this picture of kind of like the Grateful Dead or something, you know? Right? It's an amazing idea. Now, of course, it sounds ridiculous. Right? Come on, people have died, but we believe that everyone who's died has the opportunity to come back to life, right? And the Talmud says that these phenomenal, mysterious, miraculous promises of Judaism have hints in the physical world that tell us that this is possible. So can you think of a hint to the revival of the dead in the natural phenomena of the world? Waking up could be one. But what about the butterfly? Ever think about this? The caterpillar, right? When you see a caterpillar, what does he or she do? Caterpillar creates this cocoon, right? Now, from our perspective, that caterpillar looks dead. If you were to cut that cocoon open, which I hope you don't do because that's not nice, right? But if you were to cut that cocoon open, what would you see? Would you see this little caterpillar sitting in front of a mirror doing her makeup to get ready to be a butterfly? Right? You would see dead. This caterpillar looks dead. And yet this caterpillar is about to come to life in an even more magnificent form. Right? And so, our sages tell us that within the physical world, natural phenomena, there are hints to the possibility of that which looks to you absolutely dead is only a stage towards a whole new level of life. The Rambam teaches, and this is fundamental all across the board in Jewish tradition, that one of the 13 principles of faith is to believe in the revival of the dead. And that doesn't make any sense. I mean, okay, that's an interesting idea, fine. But why is it one of the core values of Judaism? So what if I don't believe in the revival of the dead? I keep Shabbat, I eat kosher. So what if I don't? Why is that so important? It's absolutely critical to truly understand Judaism that one believes in the revival of the dead. Why? So let's think about this. If the soul leaves this world and goes into this celestial state called Gan Eden, which is considered to be ecstasy, why would it be put back into this world, back into this body? Right? And yet you have to understand that according to our tradition, the revival of the dead is a reward. It's like the highlight of history. So it doesn't make sense. It looks like a punishment. Finally, I got away from the physical world. Finally got away from the struggle with my urges and my drives. And here I am frolicking away in the Garden of Eden, and now God takes me out of there and throws me back into this physical world, into this physical body? What is the revival of the dead really teaching us? It's teaching us that the goal of Judaism is really the physical. It's not the spiritual. The goal of Judaism is to reveal the godliness even in the physical. There's godliness. The fact that there's godliness and spirituality, that's easy. Right? Big deal. But to be able to show that there's godliness in the physical, that's the challenge. Now, when we come back, right, Judaism tells us that the goal of our existence on earth in these physical bodies is to expose and to reveal the godliness and the holiness within the physical, within the material, right? But if that's true, we're going to die, so that feels pretty despairing. I mean, my whole life I'm going to be working on revealing the godliness and the holiness of my physical being and the union between and the harmony between the spiritual and the physical, and now you're going to separate me? That sounds terrible. So Judaism says no, because you're going to come back. Because the goal of Jewish life is to be whole. Whole in soul, whole in body. Whole in body and soul. And that the ultimate goal of Judaism isn't so much to succeed at being spiritual and revealing godliness and spirituality. That's easy. Right? The most amazing revelation of divine truth, which I'll talk about tomorrow, is that we believe even in the physical, even the most material, even in the most physical experiences and joys of life, there is holiness and there is godliness. And that's why we must believe in the revival of the dead. Because if we didn't, then we'd fall back into this fragmented thinking that the goal of life is to get away from the body, the goal of life is to get away from the material, and the goal of life is just focus on being spiritual. In Jewish tradition, it's just the opposite. The goal of life is to reveal the godliness and holiness within the material and the physical, and to become whole. Thank you.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.